it's another episode of Death Watch, the show that you and I host together, talking about recent people, personalities who have died and their impact on the world and their impact on us personally.
Indeed.
So,
and by you and I, you don't mean your listeners and yourself. You mean the two of us.
No, I mean everyone. Yeah, no, I mean you and I, the two of us sitting across from each other. I am Matthew Price.
I'm Matthew Brown.
And we sit across from each other and then we talk.
Yeah.
So that's how podcasting works.
We should do one where we're at neighboring mics and like basically at right angles to each other so we can't
sure.
really see each other
so
without like looking at awkwardly off to the side of our eyes.
And it's both, it's like it's favorable and unfavorable because I feel like then you have the real spirit of collaboration. When you're side by side with someone, you're working together.
No, exactly. You're looking at the same thing. You're heading in the same direction.
Now what we're doing is we're opposing each other.
The worst thing that could possibly have happened to this show is that I have been binge listening to Are You Talking REM Re Me, and those two guys are not people you want to take lessons from on how to host a show
or
anything.
Is there anything
really?
You want to take a lesson
from?
Oh,
I mean, I love them. I love that show. They're both great, but good Lord, they're worse than us when it comes to the meaningless babble.
Just digression.
Yeah, just talking about whatever the hell's in their mind.
Well, let's...
anyway.
We digress.
We digress. This episode is dropping on Star Wars Day, May 25th, 2018.
Canonical Star Wars
That's
Day.
That's correct. And it will be covering the career of Japanese animator, director, producer Isao Takahata, who died just last month. Quite a recent pull for us. Last month, as I believe we said in our EbertFest episode, just festooned with deaths. A crazy number of major. This was a hard month to pick who we were
really,
going to do.
It really was.
And we're up for, we got another one coming.
Yeah.
So.
We'll talk about that in roll call. But
I
let me ask you something. How are you holding up?
It's been all right. I mean,
because.
Well, we'll talk about it in roll call, but like to give you guys a sense of, we're recording this on May 14th. So we literally found out like 3 hours ago that Margot Kidder had died.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, she was 69. She wasn't 12. Like she's been around for a while.
She had some health issues.
She had some health issues for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Died,
but I mean, that's one of those things that I mentioned on the Carrie Fisher show is that once in a while, you know, like when those ones that just, they were part of sort of your hero worship when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned then the Christopher Reeve and obviously Carrie Fisher was one of them. And Margot Kidder was definitely in that group. Like, I mean, I just had the world's biggest crush on Margot Kidder when I was like 7, 8 years old. I just thought she was the best. And I'm still just sort of processing that she's gone. And then for this episode, for Isao Takahata, I watched Grave of the Fireflies, which, by the way, great choice for Mother's Day. We'll get into that.
Oh, my. Oh, you picked the right day to watch it.
Yeah, I made a serious psychological mistake.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, again, I'm sure I've mentioned this before. One of the things I like doing this show for is that it really, you know, it forces you to reconcile with the fact that you're going to lose all these people and then eventually yourself. And that's not, I don't say that glibly. That's an important thing to remind yourself of on a regular basis because it's true. You've got these people, these creators in your life for a period of time when they'll be creating new work and then they'll be gone. And God willing, before that, they don't go completely crackers and turn into a jerk, and then you have to reconcile their entire
rewind
canon
and reevaluate.
Yep.
Oh, those things I liked.
Yeah.
Oh, those things I liked.
I like them so much.
I am, you know, starting to get concerned that this might be making me a bit morose.
This show?
Yeah. Just the constant monitoring of who's going is, you know, like I read the New York Times obituary section now as if I were my own parents.
Yeah.
I just read it.
I search on Twitter for RIP, hashtag RIP, like daily. And then when I'm not doing that, I'm checking the records of who died on this day in history. And as I said to a friend of mine, actually, when the Margot Kidder news came out, I said to her, I'm at the point in my life now where I'm getting texts when people die.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've set myself up for that.
Yeah,
so,
and I might be the one sending them.
Well,
so, yes.
Often yes, sometimes
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What we're saying is, guys, do like we do and don't binge these shows. Take a break.
Yeah, take a break. I think the fact that we do this monthly is probably good. You know, I don't think we should try to tackle all of these subjects. We'd probably just lose it.
I know I would. We lost some key people this
month. Well, so speaking of that, maybe it's time for roll call.
Sure. Here comes roll call, everyone.
Hit it.
Roll call. I'm going to try very hard in this roll call not to make any stupid jokes. Because I did that.
Okay.
I overdid that the last time.
Last time it was like
it was like a routine.
It was like you were doing a drum set.
It was like a routine.
It was like every stroke to the actual toms, you hit the rim shot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to apologize.
I mean, I don't know if that's necessary. Did we get feedback? Was someone offended?
Only I got my own internal feedback of like, you might have screwed the pooch on that, buddy. You might have blown it.
More people. Less people than concepts died in our April episode. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. So I thought, let's go
reel it in.
Back to cases. And so with all seriousness, who passed away? Vern Troyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mini me. And really nothing else. Like, I know he did other things.
Yeah.
But that ought to be enough.
No
that
way.
Is a
it's just iconic.
Those two films.
Yeah.
Tremendous performances from
absolutely.
That guy. Like, really, they're not just him. They're great. Stephen Otto, who is an urban activist in Toronto, passed away. And just because I do these in order that they happened right after we recorded our last show, I do want to mention the victims of the Alec Manassian attack.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because that happened.
Like, that happened right here in Toronto.
So 13 people killed and another 16 or 18 people injured, and that horror took place, and what that's doing to us, especially to Toronto, that is continuing to ripple.
Yeah.
So I know much more about incels than I ever wanted to know or understand.
Boy, for a concept that is meaningless and that none of us had heard of as of at least 2 years ago.
So
boy, that's everywhere now.
Yeah, I know. The only other context I have for that is actually a sketch on SNL that was about voluntary celibates.
Volcels?
They were voluntary. They were like supposed to be like teens that were celibate because they had taken a celibacy pledge, except for two guys who were like, no, we're trying our best. And that was and that was like a joke, and now we have this nonsense to deal with. So.
It's just mental.
Now, I don't know if you saw this. Bob Dureau, the age of like 90-something.
Who is that?
Bob Dureau wrote all the Schoolhouse Rock songs.
Oh.
Okay. And so he was awesome. Mm-hmm. So wrote some of my favorite songs ever written. Wrote Three is the Magic Number. Wrote Verbs, They're What's Happening. he passed away. And that is, to me, that is the greatest lyric he ever wrote. Verbs. There, what's happening?
It's pretty good.
It is. It is. Conjunction, Junction, many others. Charles Bowl, who was a Hollywood screenwriter, really not a wide career, but wrote Swim Fan, wrote some other films. He passed away relatively young. Avicii, the EDM DJ, practically a breakout star who was like sort of poised to break out of just the electronic dance music field and become like actually a pretty well-known artist, sadly took his own life earlier this month. Philip D'Antoni, who was the producer of The French Connection and French Connection 2. Paul Junger Witt.
Oh, man.
Paul Junger Witt.
Yeah.
Who, Golden Girls.
Yep.
You want to go through all the credits, but like raft of 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It was weird. Like last month we lost Stephen Bochco. We were thinking about doing him for this show.
Yeah.
And then Junger Witt very close after. I obviously immediately with Golden Girls, but I mean, he was on a lot.
Well, I think they started
Murphy Brown. Did he do Murphy Brown?
I'm not sure. I know they started with Soap.
Yeah, they
like
started with Soap.
There were a lot of, I mean, that's why Richard Mulligan came back in the Golden Girls spinoff, right?
Yep.
And the other, my favorite, like, tidbit thing is that he had a producing partner, Tony Thomas, whose father was Danny Thomas of Make Room for Daddy and The Danny Thomas Show, which is probably the first successful family sitcom prior to Leave It to Beaver. And I don't think you could find a bigger television star in the 1950s, except for Lucille Ball, than Danny Thomas. And the reason I know this, or the reason that I think it's fun, it's interesting and cool, is so Tony Thomas is named after his uncle. They are Italian. is named after his uncle, who technically his name was Anthony. They called him Uncle Tanoose. And the thing about the Danny Thomas show was that they used to do spit takes a lot, generally on the line, hey, Uncle Tanoose is coming for dinner, and then they would spit. So I always love the fact that he's named after Tanoose. That's like a comedy thing. Anyway, that's
great.
That's what I know. That's what I know. Charles Neville, the percussionist from the Neville Brothers, passed away. So I believe leaving maybe only Aaron Neville.
You're asking the wrong guy.
Senior. Now, this one I found out, this is fascinating to me. So there's a woman named Gertrude Jeanette. Died at a very advanced age, like I think almost 100. She she wrote and directed plays on Broadway. She's a woman of color. Prior to that, she was the first woman to have her taxicab license in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah. So that I thought that was really cool.
That's cool.
Michael Anderson, the film director, directed Logan's Run.
Yep.
Directed Around the World in 80 Days, for which they won Best Picture. Larry Harvey, the creator and main creative force behind Burning Man.
Right. Yes, I did see that.
Died.
Yeah.
Pamela Gidley, who was starred in Twin Peaks and was also the lead in Cherry 2000. Jabo Starks, one of two of James Brown's drummers. Not the drummer that did the funky drummer beat, the other one.
The other guy. Yeah.
But a foundational drummer. Like, sure. Pretty great. So he passed away. Art Paul, who was the original and longest serving art director for Playboy magazine. So going back
to our Hugh Hefner episode,
he created the rabbit head logo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he passed away. Film director Ermanno Olmi, director of Il Posto, among many others, again, just about a week ago. And then in the last few days, like I thought I was done. Here's what happened in the last, let's call it, less than a week.
Yes.
Ann V. Coates.
Yep.
The legendary film editor, Lawrence of Arabia, Out of Sight, like, you know, it, everything.
50 Shades of Grey.
Thank you.
Let's not forget that.
Is that the one we're going to talk about?
Well, we'll see.
Okay. Kevin Tierney, film producer from Quebec. So I was not super familiar with his work, but apparently he is very influential.
Yeah, I mean, so it's Cam this week, and a surprising depth of people over there mentioned Tierney when he passed as a massive aspect of their career. I wasn't really familiar with him either.
Will Alsop, the architect, best known in Toronto for the OCAD building, which if you have not been to Toronto, looks...
Is like the Borg Cube on stilts?
Well, I was going to say, I don't even think of them as stilts. They call them stilts because it's the building for that houses the Ontario College of Art and Design. So essentially our art school. I think of them as giant pencil crayons.
Yep, and you're probably right. Yeah. Although I've been recently told that the top is meant to be a writing desk. So then they're the feet of the writing desk?
I guess.
I don't know.
Google it if you don't live here. It is one of the most interestingly fanciful buildings. And the thing I like about Will Alsop, the thing I find interesting, is that most of what he designed never got built because it was all so strange.
Yeah.
So to see one actually built is pretty neat.
Fun fact, well, not fun fact, weird fact about that, Dutoy Alsop Hillier, the architecture firm in which he was a partner, his partner Roger Dutoy was the father of one of my best friends in high school. So I've met all those guys like at parties way back in the early 90s and stuff like that. I was at their offices plenty. And
I also had friends whose parents were architects.
Yeah.
It's strange.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Chuck Knox, who was a NFL Coach of the Year three times, coached the New York Jets in the in the original Super Bowl.
That would be Super Bowl one.
I believe it would be Super Bowl Super Bowl one. He coached Namath through the Super Bowl. My favorite thing about him, he liked the ground game so much they used to call him Ground Chuck. Which I
Great.
I love that.
I hope he loved it.
Yeah. Peter Mayer, who's from the world of publishing, he worked for Penguin. Responsible for the decision to publish the Satanic Verses.
Neat.
Yeah. Scott Hutchison, the lead singer of Frightened Rabbit. So I am not familiar with Frightened Rabbit.
Yeah, nor was I.
Boy, that was my Twitter feed for about 12 to 14 hours about a band that I had never connected with
mm-hmm.
that apparently is pretty foundational
yeah.
for people.
Yeah.
Art Shea, who was a photographer in New York City, really well known, it was with documentary style photographer.
Right.
And then lastly, Margot Kidder earlier yep. today. So, folks, that is Roll Call.
Yeah. I'm going to be away for a few weeks, so we're not going to record the June episode for about another month from now at least.
Mm-hmm.
But right now it feels like it's a runoff between doing Ann Coates or doing Margot Kidder, and I don't even want to contemplate who we will lose between now and when we might be recording that would make that decision even harder. But yeah, I mean, you'll find out, I guess, in June what we ended up doing.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Isao Takahata before we get into some of the films of his that we watched. So he was born in 35 in Mie Prefecture in Honshu in Japan. He was the youngest of seven children. He graduated from the University of Tokyo with a degree in French literature, but he became interested in animated films because of, well, this is where things get weird. So the official bio says he got interested because of a French animated film called The King and the Mockingbird, which, as far as I can tell, came out in 1980. So if anyone knows exactly what that's in reference to, I would like to know, just because that would be really mm-hmm. interesting to find out what that movie is. Please feel free to drop in on the comments at modernsuperior.com. Anyway, he went to work at Toei Animation, which is where he mentored under Yasuo Otsuka, eventually asking Takahata to direct a feature film called The Great Adventure of Horus, Prince of the Sun. That is where he began working with Miyazaki, who was the key animator on that film. The film was an enormous commercial failure, so he was immediately demoted from feature director to yep. Don't do that.
But he liked working with Miyazaki.
Yeah, so
right?
he
they
kept working
a friendship.
With, exactly. So yeah. they kept working together all the way through the 70s, kept working with Otsuka as well. They tried to get an adaptation of Pippi Longstocking off the ground that never really went anywhere. They eventually moved some of those concepts into an adaptation they did of Heidi. And then in the 80s, largely based on the success of their collaboration, Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, they formed Studio Ghibli in 1985. And
yep.
and forever confused white people like ourselves about whether it is Ghibli or Ghibli or Ghibli or Ghibli or what the proper pronunciation is. I'm going to stick with Ghibli from here on out. If anyone knows that I'm wrong, again, feel free to jump in on the comments. That'd be great. So Takahata directed some films for Ghibli, the most notable probably of which is the one that I'll be speaking about, which is Grave of the Fireflies, which came out in 1988.
Yeah, it's the most well-known here.
Yeah, yeah. certainly, yeah. yeah. Which, again, coming from our own biases. We'll get into that in a bit. But he, you know, made a film every 5 or 6 years, sort of until he decided to retire in 2013. He didn't really retire in 2013 because he was basically working at Ghibli right up until the end in various capacities. And he died this April of lung cancer at the age of 82. So that is Takahata. As is the nature of Death Watch, the goal here was to watch some of the work of the filmmaker that we had not seen before. So you were going to watch Pompoko. I was going to watch yep. Grave of the Fireflies.
And I did
that.
You
ended up watching everything.
Well, as it turned out, I had not seen any
yep.
of his films. So the second thing I did was I thought I should watch the one that you're watching just so we have something
yeah.
to talk about.
And I watched Pompoko because you enjoyed it so much. So which one do you want to do first?
Before we do that, I just want to say that having now seen not everything he ever did, but I've seen now six
wow.
things he did, because I also watched Panda Go Panda from
nice.
The 70s.
Yep.
I think the thing that's the most striking is almost like no other animator does his style absolutely change. Does the look and the feel of these films and even like the rhythms of them seem to completely change based on the source material and what is appropriate
okay.
to tell the story. That's what I think is so incredible about having watched a bunch of them.
So I only watched, you know, two subsequent films, which is I watched Grave of the Fireflies
yeah.
and then I watched Pompoko. There is definitely a fairly obvious tonal leap between the two of those.
Yeah, and but even those two are maybe the most similar in the sense that they look like Ghibli films.
Yeah, fair enough.
When you watch Only Yesterday or My Neighbors the Yamadas, it's like, oh, are these the same dude?
Mm-hmm.
They are that different.
Interesting.
They're great.
Have you seen Tale of Princess Kai?
I have. Yeah. Again, it completely different in a and all very beautiful, but looks like woodcuts. Looks
mm-hmm.
like Japanese woodcuts.
Right.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I definitely want to keep going with his work. I unfortunately left this all a little bit too late. I was just sort of cramming this weekend.
Yeah.
But I will continue to watch my way through the movies. But maybe as a way of getting started.
Yeah, for sure.
Grave of the Fireflies was always one of those, you know, signature anime movies that over here in North America, you sort of, like, when anime became popular, people said, you got to watch this. But then the thing they always followed it up with, by the way, it's also the most depressing movie you'll ever see in your life. So I was always like, you know, life's too short, man. Like, I'm sad enough most of the time. Like, let's not kill ourselves here. But I did want to see it. Like, I've heard such remarkably good things about it.
So how did you do with it?
Those people are correct.
Yeah.
That movie is devastating.
It is devastating. Although it is not devastating about the things that I thought it was going to be devastating about.
No, it's true. I don't know what I had in my head for what the movie was about to be.
I was convinced there was a nuclear aspect.
I was also convinced. I also thought it was about Hiroshima.
It is not.
No, it is just about living through the last several months of a war
that you're losing.
Of a war that you're losing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the movie is not coy about what it's going to do. Like, it is framed as spoiler warning. It is framed as a flashback of a person that you see die at the beginning. So you're not, it's not surprising that these characters pass away in the course of the movie. It's unfortunately then also just a sense of mounting dread because you know where this is going. And you basically are just watching it happen, like as the signposts of how you're going to get there become very clear. Like the little sister develops a very bad rash that you sort of see earlier on as a very faint rash, but you're like, oh, she's not doing great, and then yeah she's really not doing great. But yeah, as just an exercise, and I don't mean that in any demeaning way, just as an exercise in sort of telling the story of living in that heightened state of futility, of just like,
yeah,
there is actually no good end to
and
this.
And especially to be essentially a child with no adult resources at your disposal.
Yeah, so, and no frame of reference of sort of the larger. Like, there's a point late in the movie where he reveals that he's going to withdraw the rest of the money from his late mother's account. And my initial response was like, what are you talking about? You still had money in there. Like, why didn't you get this like 3 months ago? But then you're like, he's spent this entire movie thinking his father's going to come home, that this is a finite period, that it would be irresponsible to blast through all of their resources because they don't know like how long they're going to have to deal with certain problems. So as long as something is manageable, they'll just keep managing. But then you watch this poor kid go through these all the more extraordinary leaps of self-destruction, basically, just to try to survive. Like, there's a point at the end of the movie where he is literally running into air raid zones to steal from houses that are being destroyed so that no one will catch him stealing. And he's exhilarated. He's thrilled to be getting away with this. And you're just like, it's just heartbreaking. It is an absolutely masterful piece of storytelling.
In many ways, what I think I was most struck by is it struck me as being similar in some ways to the way that the encroaching dread is handled in Schindler's List.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is really about characters who think this is so bad, it just can't get worse.
Right.
And so all of their decisions are misguidedly based on that.
Right.
False logic.
Yeah, they think they're at the bottom.
Right.
And
like,
they're not.
Okay, my mother is disappeared. My father presumably is coming back, but we don't know where he is. So that's the worst it can get. Now my younger sibling is sick. So the way in which we make decisions based on thinking that we've already seen the worst.
Yeah.
You know, that's what reminded me, and that's, I think, to me, that's the sort of the emotional wallop of it, right?
And
he's trying so hard.
Yeah, no, he is.
Know, he's really trying so hard to protect that little kid.
Yeah,
to make sure that he's giving up for himself to give to them, and
yeah really like in almost every regard, his decisions are correct within the framework that can be understood at the time.
Yeah.
It's just...
And it's only by showing it to you in flashback that you know how ultimately doomed. It's what makes it sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is knowing that it's all, you know, to some degree, it doesn't... It's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work. I mean, I hope this isn't a facile comparison just because it's about the exact same war, but it really would make an interesting pairing with Empire of the Sun because it's told, again, from that child's perspective where that the kid just does not have a wider frame of reference. So his understanding mm-hmm. of what the rules of his life are just sort of evolving with the information that's right in front of him. And it's almost always not enough information.
Yeah.
You know, he always thinks there's, like you said, he always thinks he's at the bottom, that there's a finite end that's right there in front of him, and it's not. It's months and years away, and he's going to have to go so much further and do such worse stuff and live through so many more horrors before he gets to that bottom.
And it also, I think, you know, when I thought the film was about Hiroshima and about sort of the aftermath, like, so again, the misperception I had was that this was about people who had not been in the blast center,
mm-hmm.
but then were suffering the long-term effects of a nearby nuclear attack. This is so much more interesting,
yeah.
I think, and also I think, you know, there's so many different ways in which you can make a war film that shows the ways in which war is devastates beyond the obvious. So the other thing that I was reminded of watching it was Slaughterhouse 5.
Yeah, very good point.
Because it is not about. You know, that sense of the suffering in Slaughterhouse 5 when they talk about Dresden mm-hmm. being bombed is that was evocative of this, I think.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And I you know, it's something that, I mean, not to get too big, but in the modern world, that idea of living in a war zone where theoretically help is coming, the victors are coming, they are going to stabilize the region, but it's not going to take 20 minutes. It's not mm-hmm. even going to take 20 months. It might take 20 years.
And a lot of people are going to die in the meantime.
A lot of people are going to die before that happens. Like and they don't have a chance. Like, that's the thing that is so heartbreaking about this, is that these kids do not have it. I don't think you would need to know this was a flashback to understand these kids are royally fucked. Like, they're in a bad, inextricable situation that humans are just not meant to negotiate their way out of. It's not possible. So,
yeah. I mean, it's not helped by the fact that many of the adults are awful.
Yes. Terrible.
Like, really, there's so little sentiment applied to this. You know, not only is this terrible for him, for both of them, but then, like, the people who even tenuously are supposed to help them, like, are, you know, like that landlady is.
Yeah, their aunt is horrifying.
Awful.
And, you know, and there's even, like, late in the movie, he's negotiating with, like, a farmer for some food, and the farmer's like, I don't have anything. But you're like, how could you be, like, looking at this kid in front of you and not at least be like, but I have a barn. Like, why don't you stay in the barn and we'll figure something out, you know? Like, no, go back and live in, like, a tunnel under a hill, Bilbo. Like, what the fuck?
I also want to say that for something as bleak as sort of emotional as big as this,
mm-hmm.
this is remarkably watchable.
Yes, no,
which
absolutely.
Is incredible to think about.
Indeed.
You know, as you hear us talk about it, just like you did before you decided to watch it, I think there can be a sense of, like, I am not going to really be able to watch.
Right.
I'm not saying you're going to enjoy it, but it's not enjoyable, but it is vastly watchable.
Yeah, I mean, that was my experience with both of the films. It was certainly true with Pompoko. It's just like, I mean, Pompoko is a little easier.
Vastly enjoyable too.
Lighter
but yes.
tone, but like I was just astonished by how engaged I was, how interesting I found them, how, you know, like these, it is very rare, I will admit, for me to watch a movie on my iPad, which is what I had to do, without ever checking my phone or pausing or doing something else. Nope. I was locked in for both. I just watched them both all the way through.
Yeah.
Was very, very engaged by both movies.
And so I think one thing that he does great, and whether he's animating animals or people, and he uniquely animates people, I think, more than almost any other filmmaker. Mm-hmm. There's very few fanciful, even Miyazaki sort of like goes towards schmooze and weird fanciful creatures a lot. Most of his films are just about regular human beings.
Right.
His acting through the pen is so strong.
Yeah.
That's what's so compelling. This film that I saw called Only Yesterday, which is essentially about a 27-year-old woman trying to figure out where she wants to go with her life and thinking a lot about what happened to her in grade five. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this bifurcated film where she's remembering grade five and then going forward.
Sure.
This is just like this. There's there's quote unquote no reason for it to be animated.
Uh-huh.
It could be a movie that you could do with actors. And it's so finely acted that you're drawn right in.
That's amazing. I mean, yeah. one of the things I was thinking about with Grave of the Fireflies was the question of, you know, what would this be like as a live action film? And the answer
unbearable.
Is unbearable. Yeah, unbearable. Like, I mean, thing, the decision there to go with animation is actually quite, I think, smart because it does give you a layer that lets you not go crazy watching this movie, which you would if it was flesh and blood people. So very smart.
He's very, very good at not drawing something.
Yeah.
In a sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's talk about the magical raccoons. Yeah. My goodness.
Man. So we're in Toronto. We're Toronto guys. We know raccoons, man.
Oh, man.
We know raccoons.
I said after having watched this movie, there has never been a Ghiblier Studio Ghibli film than this.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Do you like parables? Do you like animals that are anthropomorphized? How do you feel about environmental issues? You know, like it's everything that Studio Ghibli, it really feels like.
Do you want lead characters that can occasionally turn into magical creatures?
Yeah, yeah.
To entertain people.
How about some thrilling action scenes?
Yeah,
like
Oh man.
It's that is a gift. That film is a gift.
Yeah,
and
it
also
is.
Was to my understanding is one of the biggest hits they ever had.
Yeah.
Bigger than many of the Miyazaki films.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why.
Oh, for sure.
It is even down to the nitty-gritty of like what is the takeaway message from this movie, which is astounding considering the movie's sort of like playful setup. There is a remarkably mature. The only other film I can think of that has sort of as complex a way of ending up is Happy Feet.
Yep.
Like, you know, where it's like, oh, this was not, oh.
Yeah.
This is not like the penguins win.
Yeah.
This is not the raccoons win. Far from it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I don't want to spoil the ending. But
But yeah, it is. There's much more of a negotiation there.
Yeah.
In terms of how everyone ends up.
So just to, I guess, set it up, raccoons are shapeshifters who exist playfully in nature, but Japan, being obsessed with providing more and more housing and territory for its humans, is encroaching on their habitat and shrinking it, and they decide to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And so many things about it are delightful. My favorite being the way that they subjectively draw the raccoons. So when people can see them, they look like raccoons.
Yeah.
Much like, I'll tell you the film that draws from this heavily is Ratatouille.
Yep.
Whenever humans can see the rats, they're rats.
Yep.
As soon as the humans aren't looking, they magically become much more fun looking, right? This is the same idea, but even more so because when nobody's looking at them, they can change shapes.
Yeah.
So they disguise themselves as people and go to town.
Mm-hmm.
First, they try killing people, which I liked so much.
Yeah.
They take several different tacks to get people to stop building and tearing down forest. The first one, their initial impulse is to fully murder a bunch of construction workers by making them crash their cars and shit. It's bananas.
Yeah.
It's bananas.
Yep.
Or bonkers. I don't know what word we're using this week.
I'm gonna go with bananas.
Sure. It's bananas.
Yeah.
And then my absolute favorite thing they do is they decide, okay, that killing them might not work. They seem determined to do it. Let's scare them.
Mm-hmm.
So they pretend to be ghosts.
Yep. And of course, because this is a movie, that fails because people find it too delightful.
They do. They love it and they want to see the ghosts. But also, the ghost thing is really funny.
Yeah.
So the movie is really funny. The personalities of these various raccoons are great. It's like, there's so much Pixar in this film. Like, the way that they are funny and the various personalities of these things, like, it's great.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd almost put this even a step beyond Pixar because one of the things that I really enjoyed about it was the degree to which the entire raccoon society is very multifaceted.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of different viewpoints on what to do and how to behave and how
involved to get. Yeah, it's as much about reaching consensus among the raccoons.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, again, you know, for an animated movie, a two-hour animated movie about raccoons, you wouldn't think that would be a big plot driver. But, yeah, it sure is. I mean, this thing had the disadvantage of me seeing it like a month and a half after Wes Anderson's spectacularly ill-advised Japanese pastiche, Isle of Dogs. Boy, it hands that thing its ass. Like, it's
I'm
like,
sure it does.
Oh, boy, this is how you tell it. Well, it even has, you know, the narrator with the kind of the bemused
that's the other, yeah.
voice.
And I don't know if you noticed, that's the other thing that, well, it would be in those two films, but actually in many of the films, he uses storybook narration as mm-hmm. his framing device, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
I wish more filmmakers would use it.
Yeah, I mean, I like an omniscient narrator written well. You know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
who has the sort of the
Princess Kaguya has it.
Yeah.
Only Yesterday, I believe, has it. Like it's mm-hmm. He clearly gravitates towards it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just great. And I mean, who doesn't want to watch a bunch of raccoons with huge furry nuts run around?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing.
That's the other weird
magic
thing.
Magic testicles.
Magic
yes.
testicles on these
yeah.
guys.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why yeah. not indeed?
Why not?
I have never seen testicles weaponized as yeah. effectively.
Yeah.
You know.
It's really something.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I really had a great time watching. And again, like for a two, we are very poorly socialized to animation over here, but we don't expect our animated movies to be 2 hours long. And I certainly don't expect them to be 2 hours long and very engaging.
Yeah.
Like where I'm like, I wouldn't yeah. cut a frame of this. Every yep. scene is terrific. Everything
yep.
that happens has moment and movement in the yep. plot. You know, this is great.
I want to talk a little bit about the one film out of these that's very different from all the others.
Please.
Which is My Neighbors, the Yamadas.
Sure.
So I did not know anything about this. Within 5 minutes, it's clear that what this is it's Japan's version of Peanuts. It's Charlie Brown style comic strip that used to run a 4-panel manga.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a comic strip that used to run in the newspaper every day, turned into a movie, which is a bunch of sickly hilarious vignettes about a family.
Great.
That are just super well observed and funny. And it's done exactly in that Charles Schulz style, a very simple, almost no background, simple lines. It looks very hand-drawn. It's, again, nothing like any of his other films.
Wow.
Totally enjoyable for any age. Take a little kid. One of the few times that I would say it's probably okay to watch the dubbed version.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, but you probably could get away with it.
Oh,
because,
I'm a big fan of dubbed versions, by the way.
Yeah.
I got no problem with
that. You know,
versions.
Because it is just like, you know, as an example, the father decides, I'm going to show the son there at dinner. He goes, why don't you have some sake? There to the teenage son. Have a little sake. See how that goes. So the kid drinks a little and he's sort of like, puh, puh. And he goes, see, pretty strong, eh? And the kid goes, it's kind of sweet.
Oh, dear.
Stuff like that. It's just that for like
right.
2 hours. And it's like, that's great.
Oh, man. I am looking forward to watching all of these.
Yeah.
As a person who never really went crazy for Ghibli, for Miyazaki Ghibli. You know, like which
I am up and down. There are some that are in the, and I'm different from everybody else because the ones that I think are the best are not what everybody else thinks are
right.
the best.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of like they just sort of peak at a certain point for me, and they don't ever really, like, you know, clear the bases. Yeah, clear the bases. I don't know sports, but yeah, like both of these, I want to go through the rest of his work, which is not many as a director. It's like a total of 6 or 7, I think.
It's like 5 features
yeah.
In the modern era, and then I guess if you want to go back and try to find a copy of Horus, which
oh,
is
I
on,
do.
Well, it's on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I'm gonna
so
I'm gonna see what I can do there.
It could be. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for listening. This episode, I would actually probably not behoove us to mention that this episode was basically a plea from one of our listeners, which is Andrew Robinson, who just said, man, I would love it if you guys would do this, which again,
I hope we,
back
then
we were seriously considering doing some of the other people that had just died.
Yeah.
But
I hope, Andrew, that we did a good enough job. Yeah. I hope you feel like we've scratched that itch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we ran a poll on Twitter just to kind of like get a straw poll on the 4 or 5 candidates at that particular moment, and Takahata won by a long shot, like was the clear favorite. So, and mm-hmm. boy, am I glad he did. I'm sorry he's gone, but you know, like I just,
yeah.
This was a very enjoyable experience for me. Hopefully it was a very enjoyable experience for all of you and for you as well.
Get out and watch these films. They're great.
Yeah, they really are terrific.
This was absolutely a great experience for me because this was I had not cracked this open at all.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
unusual for me. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, thanks everyone for listening. You can leave comments at modernsuperior.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and in the Play Store. If you do so, don't forget to leave a review. We love reviews. Reviews are great. You can follow us on Letterboxd at Death Watch Pod. You can follow us on Twitter at Death Watch Pod. If you see anyone else on, say, like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Death Watch Pod, they're pretending to be us.
Are there people?
I doubt it.
What?
But who knows? Okay. If you see that, let us know.
Sure.
They're pretending. They're using our data.
We'll make a call.
Yeah.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.